Just in case, Waiheke, you didn't get enough of that intro, this is Andy Durrant. This is Mostly Locally. I see Mike Gray, my guest, running into the studio as I speak. Here he is. He comes walking in. Mike, you're on that mic there. Good morning. How are you?
I'm really well, Andy. It's nothing like putting you on your toes.
It was a nice jog you had going across the...
I've actually been sitting outside for 5 minutes watching you stress.
So. Oh, really?
Yeah, I was here. I was just seeing how you could...
You're making me work for my... Well, I work for nothing, actually. I don't get paid, but... That's because it's a community radio station, and being a community radio station, we've got interesting people from the community. Today, we've got Mike Gray, and Mike, you're the president of the Waiheke Football Association. You're a local businessman. You're an expat Cantabrian. You found your way onto the island after the earthquake, is that right?
Yep, 3 years ago, February earthquake. 2 days after the earthquake, we got to our house, and we realised we didn't have one anymore, and we just... There was 200 people lined up at the local school getting water because we had no water, power, or sewage, and we just thought wife was pregnant. Christchurch isn't going to be a very good place to live for a while. And so we made a choice to move cities on the spot, basically. Went inside the house, got passports, a bit of stuff, and we left the next day.
Crazy.
Yeah.
And how did you get the rest of your stuff out? What happened to the contents?
We then went back maybe... I think we ended up on Waiheke maybe 3 weeks later because we went to Palmerston North first and we thought...
That's a good choice.
Yeah. My wife's mum's from there. We're like, no, we're not living here.
Can I ask why?
Oh,
is that inflammatory?
It just, you know.
Anybody from Palmy out there, Waiheke?
Well, I think Mark Twain, when he did a tour of New Zealand in the early 1900s and he didn't stop it. He refused to stop at Palmerston North. He made the coach keep going, apparently.
Is that right?
Yeah, so I don't know. That's why. There was sort of an escape a website where you could get a free accommodation, and there's a few places on Waiheke. So my wife came here with her sister's family, and they just to check it out. And then I flew in, having packed up 4 houses in Christchurch and loaded 2 houses into a truck.
Yeah.
And that was being driven up, and we started looking for places to rent.
Yeah.
And then the truck arrived a few days later.
Wow.
And that was 3 years ago in March.
And how did your wife find Waiheke?
We'd lived in Auckland before.
Yeah.
I looked to live here about 20 years ago.
Right.
When I was 18. Peter Rowley was resident on the island, and I was writing for Billy T. James then.
Oh, writing for him?
Yeah.
Oh, is that right?
And I'd met Peter in Christchurch, so I stayed with Peter on the island for a bit.
Yeah.
Just because I'd moved up from Christchurch and...
Oh, wow, I had no
idea. In fact, I would have bought a place here.
Yeah.
I think it was about $18,000.
Yeah.
In Surfdale.
Nice.
But then Billy passed away.
Right.
So I lost my job and my income. And
crazy. Peter Rowley still to this day is one of the best one-liners I've ever heard, which was, I'd rather have a bottle in front of me than a funnel lobotomy.
Yes.
Remember that scene in the pub? Was that your work?
No, that wasn't mine, but yeah.
I did like that.
But I did a show here with Peter. Well, I didn't really do a show. Peter did his show... Billy T and me at Artworks a couple of years ago on the 20th anniversary of Billy's death, which made happen, and I just introduced him. But
very cool.
I'm still in touch with Peter.
Wow.
Yeah.
So you writing comedy, do you still do a bit of that?
No. After Billy passed away, I couldn't get any work because people were like, well, what have you done? And you're like, well, I've written a show that hasn't been made and you'll never see.
Yeah.
Or come back when you've got some experience, was the typical kind of thing.
Yeah.
And at that time, you know, New Zealand comedy, the shows were few and far between.
Hell yeah.
Well,
there's a lot of New Zealand comedy. It's just, it's called drama. It's called Shortland Street. I find that hilarious. It's terrible.
Well, I was actually on Shortland Street.
No way.
I've played 3 different characters on Shortland Street, which you'd think would be a record, but I know someone else who's played 3 different characters.
Is that right?
Yeah, and that, not that they know that. And I haven't been on that show for... Well, that's going back probably 20 years.
What was the span between characters?
Well, they went big, you know, they went long characters, so...
Yeah, but any sharp-eyed fans pick you up, hey, that guy's the same guy as the other dude?
Well, no, but my plan is, because I could spend a 20-year gap, to go back on now.
Yeah, that'd be great.
And then maybe try and squeeze another, like get to 5. and then put a montage together. So far I've been Spike, a drug dealer.
Nice. Were you successful or did you get rumbled?
No, it was a very small part.
Yeah, Spike the drug dealer.
I was Hoon number one, and I took Gina to her wedding. Gina, and then I was Agent Green. I was a secret agent.
You're a secret agent.
Yeah,
there was a secret agent.
I kidnapped Lionel and Kirsty. So, you know, but
high drama.
But I'd love to get another couple.
You should
of
go
roles.
For five. I think that'd be a good thing.
Yeah, and then just put it all together. And you know, am I New Zealand's most versatile actor?
Possibly.
Yeah.
I used to know a guy called Milton Jones. I don't know if you've heard of him, but he's a UK stand-up, and he's quite popular now in the UK, but it's taken him like 30 years to get to where he is. But his claim to fame was he was actually in EastEnders as the lurking stalker. I've still got these everlasting images of Milton in this kind of trench coat, standing on the square at night, you know, with a bit of rain. And there he is, kind of leering at this girl. Yeah. It's hilarious. So,
but you would do those sorts of things to get money.
Yeah, of course.
You know,
what, so stalking?
I've done my fair bit of stalking. But the point I was trying to make was what I do. Yeah, so I ended up becoming a stand-up comedian.
Right.
Because no one could stop you doing it.
Yeah.
You turned up at, there was only two venues. It was Kitty O'Brien's, which was at McMarket, and a hotel in Albert Street. Which is still there, but I forget its name now.
Yeah, I think I know. It's the Shakespeare, wasn't it? Is it the Shakespeare?
No, but they were the two places where there was a regular stand-up gig, and you would perform free. Yeah. And then occasionally they'd have a prize where, you know, it would be $100 to the winner of a thing.
Yeah.
And that to me was sort of like gold.
Yeah. And did you win?
No, I'd get second. And the winner would be a joke teller.
Yeah,
and I'd be irate because I didn't think telling jokes was stand-up comedy.
No.
And that's what used to really annoy me. But the problem was I was now squatting in a car park basement in Merrill Drive next to the Aotea Centre.
Yeah.
And because one of the producers one of the owners of the production company that was making Billy's show, he ran Easy Park, which was a big car parking company.
Yeah.
And so Princess Wharf used to be a big car park before they built the Hilton and that. And he had a car parking building there and he said to me, hey, you could put a comedy club in the basement.
Yeah.
And I thought, that would be brilliant. The comedy basement was what I was going to call it. So I got the council down to come and have a look at this, you know, my comedy basement. And the guy's like, are you mad? You know, you need fire egresses and sprinkler systems and all this sort of stuff. And as he started talking, I realized that the comedy basement was not going to happen.
I was going to stay in the basement.
But I was standing there looking at the room that was going to be the green room or the office or whatever, and I thought, I could live here. and it had power, and it had a toilet and a shower and running water. And I boarded up this office. I overturned a bookcase and I filled up a waterbed that I had with a fire hose. And I lived in a box.
That's brilliant.
Yeah,
in a basement.
Yeah, and on Tuesday and Thursday nights, I obviously wasn't aware of this at the time, but the orchestra from the Auckland Symphony Orchestra would park in what was effectively my backyard.
Your living room.
Yeah, and the doors would open, and, oh, what's going on here? And all these cars would come in. So I learnt that I had to have the music off or the lights down.
Just keep your head down for the as they parked.
Yeah, and then as they came back and left. And So I lived in this box, and because I'd boarded it up so no one could see I was in there, sort of no natural light came in, and I started to get depressed because I was running out of money.
Yeah.
And the idea was I didn't want to go back to Christchurch with my tail between my legs because I just left, you know.
Yeah.
I'd been working at the Big Fresh in Christchurch.
All right.
I'd finished school. It had been like a part-time job, right?
Yeah.
And now it was... didn't go to university. Well, I wanted to do fine arts, but I didn't get in. I got a fine arts disagree. That's where you apply, but they say...
Yeah, they say no.
Yeah, they say you're crap at painting. So I got a disagree. And so I thought, well, I just, you know, at Big Fresh, I said, well, do you want more hours? Yes. And suddenly I was working 7 days a week. And this is in the time of double time and a meal allowance and a travel allowance and a clothing allowance. And I'm like... Mum does my washing.
Yeah.
Dad gives me the car. He pays for the petrol. You know, you pay me to eat. It was just incredible.
You're high on the hog.
And then, but I worked 7 days a week for a long period of time. And I used to do work in the freezers because no one liked it. But I'd basically go in there for a bit of a snooze. And you'd always find me moving dog rolls but I just sort of moved them from one place to another, and I'd start again and just move them back. And
you went to a snooze in a fridge, in a freezer.
Well, I just sort of, you know, a bit of quiet time. But while I was there, I met Peter. Peter Rowley comes into the supermarket. Right. Now, prior to this, I was telling everyone that I was going to be a comedian. I was going to write for Melitti James. You know, that was the plan.
Yep.
And one day, Peter Rowley walks in, and I thought, whoa, there's the opportunity. There's the guy. So I literally ran over to him and said, hey, Peter, how are you, mate? He's like, oh, yeah, oh, good, thanks. Hey, listen, can I get some of that fillet steak there? And we just sort of have a bit of a chat, and I go, hey, you doing anything with Billy at the moment? And he's like, oh, actually, yeah, we're about to start writing a new show. Just those two pieces there, please. And so while I'm getting his fillet steak, I'm trying to ingratiate myself with it. I'm like, oh, well, I'm actually a writer. Oh, yeah, I should, you know, get your details, mate. And he goes, yeah, you know, and he's not really that interested. And how much is that going to cost? And I knew how to manually override the system, so I printed off a 50-cent label and gave him about $30 of fillet steak
for 30 cents.
50 cents.
Courtesy of Big Fresh.
Yeah, and he goes, is this right? And I went, yeah, giving a bit of a look, you know, and he said, oh, right. I'll give you my address then, eh? And I went, oh, that'd be good. So he gives me his email or whatever it was. Yeah. I don't think you had email back then. And I then went to the library, got a book out on how you type up scripts.
Yeah.
And I still actually have the originals, and there's no lines between them. It's just line after line of content.
Yeah.
And sent them, and they then went to Auckland, and Billy read them in hospital because he was recovering from his heart transplant, or he'd had a, you know, gone back in or whatever, a relapse. And so he read these in hospital, and I made him laugh, and from that I got a call 2 weeks later, do you want to move to Auckland?
Is that right?
To write for the show.
That's brilliant.
And so I've left Big Fresh, though. You know, it was like the scene out of Officer and a Gentleman where he comes back to get the girl.
Yeah, yeah.
Except it's me walking out with my gum boots.
Nice.
And everyone's like, he's going to work for Melitti James. Yeah. How does that work? What?
Did you ever fess up to Big Fresh that they actually sponsored your...
No.
So you owe Big Fresh $29.50?
Yeah, probably. And although they got it from, you know, I worked hard for them. But I didn't want to go back, you see. Now he's died, I don't want to have to go back to the Big Fresh.
Yeah.
With my tail between my legs. So naturally what you do is you go, well, how do I stay in Auckland without any money and a job? Well, I'll start squatting in a car park basement.
That's
beautiful. And I'll live on mince pies. You see, so when you're now in a box eating mince pies, they were a dollar back then, mince and cheese, dollar mince pie, Irvings.
Well, you weren't Big Ben.
No, dollar mince pies.
Yep.
So when you could win $100 at a comedy competition, well, that meant to me two weeks of survival.
Yeah.
Because I was just trying to eke out to Christmas, then I'd go home.
Yeah.
To lose to a joke teller.
Yeah, it's harsh.
When it's a stand-up comedy competition.
Yeah.
Have you heard this one? What about this one?
That's terrible. Just like,
Doesn't that
epitomise New Zealand comedy, though?
Well, it did back then.
Yeah. Do you think it's better now?
There's a lot more opportunity.
Yeah. So now. Do you still dabble?
No, I'm currently still writing a show in my head. I stopped doing it because I realised that I was going to go crazy. So I now tour the country, and you're doing gigs where, you know, they don't want the pool table game that's in front of the stage to stop for the show.
So,
do you mind if they keep playing?
Keep playing while you're trying to make people laugh.
Yeah, so you would then, you know.
That's impossible.
I did a gig in town where we arrived. It was a group of us on a Sunday night, and they'd forgotten we were coming.
Nice.
They had made some flyers, so then they said, well, we're not paying you unless you can get an audience. This is a Sunday night.
Unbelievable.
Here are the flyers. So we then go down to Queen Street.
Yeah.
And Sunday night, and they give us sort of 2-for-1 drink deals, and we conjure up 50 people or something to come up.
Yeah.
You know, we'll start in about an hour.
Yeah.
Just trying to get the audience ready. And then, so then we go to do the show because now we've got some people.
Yeah.
And they've got no sound gear or anything, so the mic got plugged into the stereo system and you stood behind the bar.
Nice.
With a serving prop.
Nice. Did you show from there?
And then at the end, some patron had vomited in the toilet and they wanted us to clean it up. And they said they wouldn't pay us if we wouldn't clean it up. And we refused to clean up this vomit. It's like, we don't work here. We're the act.
Yeah. We got 50 people in here for
it. So we then walk. We're not prepared to do this. This is just ridiculous. But on the way out, I found $5 on the ground.
Oh, what a...
And I picked it up, and that was my first paid gig. So this is an era of, you know, you're standing behind a bar.
Yeah, I love it.
Or the pool table game's still going.
Yeah, yeah.
Like it was hard enough to be in a band 20 years ago, but to be a comedian, a stand-up comedian, was insane.
Almost impossible.
So I look at it now, and, you know, obviously with Flight of the Conchords doing well, and Rhys Darby, I mean, you know, he went to... London and spent 18 years just gigging.
Slogging it.
Yeah. So, you know, all credit to them.
I used to go to those clubs in London, the Bearcat Club in Twickenham. It was ferocious. It's such a ferocious environment, stand-up.
Yeah.
Seeing some guys bomb is just desperately...
horrible. Yeah, well, I went to John Giller's and Comedy Store when I was 18.
Yeah.
It was just before I moved to Auckland. I went to London for a couple of weeks.
Yeah.
And while I was there,
how many
pies
did that cost?
Well,
it must have cost a lot of pies.
I was with Dad then, so Dad was paying for that.
Nice.
This is before I've even moved to Auckland. And I was just transfixed by it and thought, yeah, that's what I'm doing. I was a huge fan of The Young Ones and Adrian Edmondson and Rick Mail. And I'd read the history of comedy in England, and I thought, oh, good, I'll become a stand-up comedian and then I'll get my own TV show.
Yeah.
I'd written the pilot, and it was Wizard Grey's Punctual Raincoat. Was what it was called. It's very Monty Python-ish, and
yeah,
and I found it recently. I read it, and it was terrible. I had a character that, in brackets, said a lot like Neil off The Young Ones.
Yeah,
and I was like, no, that is Neil
off the Young Ones. Yeah, a bit of plagiarism.
Yeah, kind of.
Did I steal a whole character?
The same character. In fact, I've described it as the character off that show. But I was young, and
well, how old were you when you were writing that though? That's still.
18, you know,
yeah, but
18.
That's quite amazing, really, given the, you know, the balls to do that kind of stuff. It's
very
brave, isn't it?
Yes. Oh, well, I actually wanted to be a singer more than a comedian, and I was in a band.
What kind of music? What genre?
Original music, you know.
Yeah, but would it fit into back in those days? What was it?
I liked Radiohead, Pearl Jam, U2,
right?
Okay. Something.
Yep.
And I probably lacked confidence as a singer. I felt more comfortable being on stage saying, laugh at me, than take me seriously.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, you could have achieved both.
Yeah. Yeah. Well,
you could have been in a glam rock band.
Yeah. Or I could have been a singer that I wanted people to take seriously, but you just laughed at.
Yeah.
Yeah. So... I have this yin and yang thing between music and comedy.
Outstanding. But something else won, obviously.
Well, no, I just started doing the comedy thing. But now that there's an industry now, there's laugh festivals and stuff. I suggested to all the comedians at the time, like Jeremy Corbett, who hosts 7 Days. So he was a stand-up back with his brother Nigel. And,
yep.
You know, Kitty O'Brien's, and that was sort of it.
Yeah.
And... I suggested we do a show at the St. James.
Yeah.
And like the, you know, Secret Policeman's Ball, that kind of thing. And everyone thought I was mad. I'm like, what?
Yeah.
No, this is what they do in England. We should all get together and do one big show. And, you know, instead of doing 10 minutes, let's all do 20 minutes or half an hour each. And, you know, it's one big night.
Yeah.
And, they all thought I was a bit mad. And then that came along maybe 2 or 3 years later. They started doing stuff like that.
Yeah.
And then the Scott opened the comedy club in Queen Street, and, you know. But I just recognised at the time that there was no industry. There was nowhere really for me to go. I wasn't going to get a television career out of it.
Yeah.
And because it was such a hard lifestyle, I was going to go insane. So I left and decided I would start going to business.
Right.
And become an entrepreneur, effectively. And that's what I've done for the last 20 years. But in between, I've fantasised about going back to being a comedian, or
could you not be both?
Yeah.
I think you should. Anyway, we're going to cut to your first track, Mike, because we've covered a lot of ground, I have to say, and I want to come back to the bit about Christchurch and just because I think there's a number of expat Cantabs now living on Waiheke, and it must be quite a traumatic experience, you know, uplifting and moving. But we'll just go to your first track now, which is Brian Eno and David Byrne. Now, tell us a bit about why you picked this.
I picked this song because it's just got a really great groove to it. So sometimes I like music that has a great groove.
Yeah.
And it's off... I was a huge Talking Heads fan.
Yeah.
And it's off an album called Everything That Happens Will Happen Today. And Dave Boone played in Wellington maybe 4 or 5 years ago, touring this album. And I thought, it's like, I'll never see Talking Heads play. I'll never see Dave Boone play live. And so I literally booked a ticket off Trade Me. I was driving out to the airport in the taxi trying to book a hotel. My wife was booking the flights. I was flying up. The show was that night, and the next day I was busing to Palmerston North where I had a meeting.
Yeah.
So it was all last minute impromptu. And while I was in the taxi, I decided I'd book this hotel where they had a a lounge in Europe where you generally there's free alcohol and free food. And
oh
free
yeah, yeah, it's got a business a business floor.
So I paid extra for this, thinking I would get this food and alcohol, and I could quickly drink before the concert. I didn't even have his new album, so I could download it or all that sort of stuff.
Yeah.
As I fly into Wellington Airport, I'd go straight into the CD store that was there in the domestic terminal, bought the CD, go to the hotel, check in, get into this lounge area, cups of tea and coffee and a few little biscuits, and that's it. There's no alcohol. There's no internet. You've got to pay for your internet. So I then start downloading, just finding set lists. What songs is he going to play? And, okay, he plays these tracks off the album and this is one of them, and it's just a brilliant song. But while I'm in the building, I then I shoot out to go get something to eat, I buy a bottle of wine, and as I'm coming back in, I meet a guy I knew from Christchurch, and he says, "Oh, what are you doing here?" And I says, "Oh, I'm going to the David Byrne concert." And he says, "Oh, I'm working on it. I'm just here to pick David up."
No,
he's upstairs and he's getting his bicycle. So David bikes everywhere when he's in a city. He likes to bike around. In fact, he's written a book about all his biking travels.
Is that right?
Yeah. So he's got a bicycle, and you know how they wheel out the equipment in those black kind of cases?
Yeah, the flight cases.
So his bike's in one of these. So he's upstairs getting his bicycle.
Yeah.
And I think, shit, hey, could you get him to sign my CD for me? So I go up to my room to get the CD, to bring it down for this guy to get him to sign it for me. And as I leave the room, I forgot the CD. It's sitting on the bed. So I'm trying to get back in, and the green card, the slot
isn't firing.
Won't go green. It's
keep talking.
Won't go green. Oh, there we go.
Ah, geez, what happened there?
I don't know. Power cut.
That's spooky.
It won't go green. And about 4 or 5 times.
Yeah.
And then finally I'm in, get the CD, go hop in the lift, and another guy gets on at my floor. And then we go down a level, and ding, opens the door. It's the presidential suite thing.
Yeah.
And there's David
Byrne. There's David Byrne getting into the lift.
And he's like, "Is there room?" Because he's got his big bike. And I'm like, "Yes, Mr. Byrne." So he walked,
Mr. Byrne.
Yeah, I called him Mr. Byrne. And he comes in. And I'm holding, it's really weird, I'm holding my CD in one hand and a pen in the other. And I go, "Would you sign my CD for Mr. Byrne? I'm a huge fan." And he's like, "Yeah, sure." Then ding, the floor stops at like level 2. And the other guy gets out.
Yeah.
So he moves back. And now I'm just with him in the lift. And
yeah,
I'm like,
nice.
"Hey, David, I've been working on this idea of getting famous artists to record some of their songs in Te Reo Māori, Would you be interested in that?" And he says, "Sure, that sounds like a cool idea." And I go, "Well, I'm actually talking to Neil Finn about it at the moment. He's quite interested." And he goes, "I know Neil. I'm staying at his house tomorrow night."
Oh, no.
Ding, the door's open. We now go No, actually, I didn't have a pen. I had my card, my business card, because I was going to give it to the guy. So now we go to the thing, because he's going to sign my thing. So we go up to the reception just to get a pen. And he takes out the lyric book.
Yeah.
And he writes his personal email address in it.
Yeah.
And says, "I've given you my email address." And he puts it back and gives it to me. Then I go to his concert. I have the most outrageous night. I get right up to the front.
Yeah.
To the point where I slowly nudge one guy out. So I'm dead center at the front, at his feet by the mic stand. And at the very end of the concert, I leap up on stage and I grab the set list.
Yeah.
Then I managed to talk myself backstage with 2 other people from Christchurch.
Outstanding.
Because we pretended we knew the bass player. Because I worked out what his name was.
Yeah.
And when we got backstage, it was really like straight and nothing was happening.
Yeah.
And the bass player goes, "You tricked me."
"You tricked me.
I don't
me.
Know you guys. You've tricked me." And we go, "Okay, we'll leave." And we left. But this is Strange Overtones.
Yeah. We'll play it now. It's the longest intro to a song I've ever heard, Mike.
getting colder tonight. A snowball in my kitchen. I watched it melt before my eyes. Your song still needs a chorus. I know you'll figure it out. The rising of the verses, a change.
Something I recognise about religion that us evangelical atheists haven't really grappled with yet, which is that it gives people a chance to surrender. What religion says to you, essentially, is you're not in control. Now, that's a very liberating idea.
Well, it was a sudden and abrupt end there. That was Brian Eno, David Byrne and Brian Eno with Strange Overtones. Mike and I were in mid-conversation there. We got caught out. But apparently a study's been done, Mike, that, you know, the more errors that come into a radio show, the more the audience associates with you because it's just being human. So we're okay.
Well, you know, you often hear, this is my criticism of radio hosts, you know, they're kind of like, they're just... talk absolute drivel most of them. They're like, wow, yeah, like last night I made some tuna sandwiches and my cat came and ate some of them. Anyway, this is the...
Yeah, I know. What the hell, what's the point?
Yeah.
But isn't that Gen Y, mate? Isn't that kind of where we're at? Sorry, with millennials, it's that level of, you know, they've reached new heights of shallowness.
Well, you go to a nightclub now and they'll play a song that you like for 30 seconds and then they switch it to another one.
Yeah.
They don't play songs the whole way through now because
music for ADHD.
Well, yeah, it's the attention spans. Oh, they got bored, so we better switch it.
Switch it.
There's
yeah.
a certain panic, I think.
Yeah.
That if I play the whole song, I might lose them.
Yep.
But Brian Eno gave David Byrne a whole lot of music, so he wrote all the music and just said, "Here,
do what you do.
Write some lyrics and put over the top. And
yeah.
Let's put out an album." So that's how that came about.
It's very groovy. I do respect David Byrne just because, you know, he brought true nuttiness to pop, I suppose, didn't he?
Mm.
He did. He always did things his own way anyway. Speaking about doing things your own way, you certainly seem to have done things your own way. Going from stand-up comedian living in a box in a car park to running your own reasonably successful business, I'm assuming. I don't know much about it. What is it you do, Mike? What is Aid Media?
Aid Media is a billboard advertising company that is about to rebrand. My wife and I used to own the largest billboard company in Christchurch.
Yep.
And then we sold that in 2004. Went on a bit of a overseas trip.
Yep.
She got pregnant. I was the father.
That's nice.
Yeah. And we came home and had babies, and then I sort of, did a few other things and dabbled in commercial property, and then the financial crisis hit in 2008, and I had sort of fingers and pies, and all those pies needed money.
Yeah.
Suddenly I could see money was going to be hard to come by, and so I started another billboard company just because, well, I'd already sort of started it, but it was just, I knew how to make money.
Yeah.
It's a good cash flow business.
Yeah.
And now...
was there no restraint of trade when you sold the previous business?
I had 5 years, so
okay.
That had expired.
Nice.
And yeah, so I started up again, but we won the Canterbury Business of the Year for when we had the company, and I won the 2000, I was the Ernst & Young Entrepreneur of the Year for that company.
Wow.
So
that's impressive, dude.
Yeah. So, it was a good business. And
yeah.
And I have been for 20 years after Big Fresh, and I moved back to Christchurch eventually to fatten up. I had a job at Telecom for about 9 months.
Wow, what were you doing?
018.
Was that Hereford Street?
Yeah, it was horrible.
Were you in the call centres in Hereford
Street? Yeah, but
is that right?
See, 018 was East Germany, and 123 was West Germany.
Yeah.
So if you worked at 123, you're sales. Call minder and all this.
Yeah.
And because you made the money, you got
invested and
you got paid money in that.
018.
I gave
scum
phone numbers.
Yeah.
So we were scum, and I was in East Germany.
Well, you'd be pleased to know, have you been outsourced to Manila or somewhere in the Philippines?
But then it really was. There was this divide between. And I used to go into the VDU room, which was a break visual display unit, a break from the screen, and I would tell everyone that I was planning to escape, and I'd been building a tunnel under the Coke vending machine, and Gavin, one of the oldest guys on the floor, him and I had made a hang glider, and he was going
to fly it.
He was going to try and fly off the roof. And some of the ladies that couldn't come with us would make fake bus passes. And if we could get out to Ferrymead, I had a friend there that could get us on a boat. And I had this elaborate thing going because it really felt like we're in East Germany.
Yeah.
And so for 9 months I did this job. And while I was doing it, at the same time I started my company.
Yeah.
So I'd work from some 3:30 to 11. I'd do the late shift.
Yeah.
Come home and I'd work from 8 till 3. Running my business,
yeah,
but I needed the income from the job to
supplement. Yeah.
So I was just working ridiculous
hours.
And as the tolls started to come on, I started to get less and less concerned about how I did my job.
Yep.
And let's just say that I became a bit of a larrikin or
got a bit loose.
Yes, and so because what happened is. The phone would ring and you had like 25 seconds to answer the call.
Yeah.
And I was actually quite a good operator, but it was like you'd have to go, "Welcome to Telecom Director Michael speaking. Thank you. How are you spelling that, please? Thank you. One moment, please. Sorry, what's the street address? Thank you." And you'd find it like that.
Yeah.
"Thank you. Welcome to Telecom Director Michael speaking.
Yeah.
Sorry, how are you spelling that, please? Sorry, and what city is that, please? Sorry, do you have a street address? Thank you." And you do that, and as soon as you'd finish one, it would just come in.
Yeah.
It would be then ping, ping, ping.
Yeah.
And then they...
So how many calls a day?
You
must have got up to in the hundreds of hundreds.
Yes, it was. And I had, I'll get to this, but I had the fastest call times on the floor. So I answered more calls than anyone else.
Yeah.
Then they come in and they go, "Oh, look, we want to speed up the process. We want you to answer them in 18 seconds. So now you don't say thank you.
Yeah, just...
You push a button, the button says, "Thank you, your number is,"
Nice.
And so, and that just made it even faster, more and more calls. But one day I was up at InCharge, is where they ran the floor, and they were explaining how it all worked, and this logs all the calls, and this is,
And
I said, "Oh, what's that line?" He says, "Oh, that's if someone hangs up on you. If they hang up on you, it logs
as a
0 second call."
Yeah.
And I put that little nugget at the back of my head. And then I found a loophole in the system, you see.
Yeah.
So I realized that if someone hung up on me, it would log as a 0 seconds call, which would be good for my time averages. So what I would do is late at night, someone would ring up and I'd talk to them for half an hour.
Yeah.
Or there'd be a party.
Yeah.
And, "Hey, do you want to talk to the telecom guy?" And the phone would get handed around.
Yeah.
And I'd just have an hour-long conversation with people.
Yeah.
And then I would then look at my call times and it said my average call time was 45 minutes or something, you know.
Yeah.
Then I would sit there and hang up on every caller that came through. I'd hang up on them.
Yeah. But bing, and that's still registered as a
call in 0 seconds.
Nice.
And I'd do that for 5 minutes and then I'd check my times. I'm now down to 7 minutes average time call, you know.
Yeah.
And I just kept going until I got about 15
right.
seconds. And I had the fastest call times on the floor.
Awesome. It did no work.
Well, I had a conversation. I just this was towards the end, and I couldn't take it anymore.
No, call centers do that to you, don't they?
Yeah, and then I happened to take a particular call where the man who rang up asking for a number, and I gave him some advice not to use that company.
Because
the guy who used it was a bit of a jerk.
Yeah,
because I'd parked one of my mobile advertising trailers on this person's land.
Yeah,
he had towed it away. Clamped it and made me pay him $500 to get it out of, the pound.
Yeah.
So that was a lot of money for me at the time. So I told this guy I wouldn't use that guy, this finance company, because the guy's a jerk. Anyway, the guy who rang up was the guy who owned it, and he was ringing just to check that his listing was right.
Beautiful.
So then I get called in to a meeting.
Yeah.
If you want to bring a witness, that's fine, which is always an interesting line when you get told. Oh, it's just a meeting, but... If you want to bring a witness, I'm fine. So I go in and there's four people sitting down there and there's two notebooks raised with pencils and this call and do you remember it? And I immediately remembered it, but I said, I think I know what you're talking about. I pretty much copped to it, but I didn't 100% cop to it.
Yeah.
And then they said, well, you go away tonight, think about it and come back in the morning. Okay. So I leave the room and I go up to a union member and I say, look, what do I do? And they said, deny it. Come back tomorrow, take a witness and just say it wasn't you.
Yeah.
So the next morning I come in, go in, I go, it's all right if I bring a witness. Yes, yes. So we go back in, all notebooks are raised. My witness has got a raised notebook.
Yeah.
I go, yeah, no, look, so I was thinking about it overnight and no, it wasn't me. there are three Michaels that work on the floor.
Yeah,
they were all working on the day in question because I've checked the staff timetable thing.
Yeah,
I've had a look in the database, and there are 13 finance companies that start with A. As you know, I have the fastest call times on the floor, which means I answer more calls than anyone else here. So, in the course of a day, it's very common that I get phone numbers for finance companies because the 13 start with A. When you said, I just presumed.
Yeah,
that you knew it was me.
Yeah,
but I can't remember it, and it's not the sort of thing I'd do.
Yeah,
jaws dropped, pencils wavered, notebooks flattered.
Is that right?
They didn't know what to do.
Nice,
but they knew it was me.
Yeah, but they couldn't
prove it.
Is that right?
And then I read my contract, and I said that I wanted to leave, and they paid me out 3 weeks. And
nice.
And I left. And then I started running my business full time. So the point of that story, Andy, was that was the last job I had. That was over 20 years. So for 20 years, I have been manifesting my future and my income from my own mind.
That's very good.
Yeah, 20 years of that.
20 years of that. And I suppose that must feel pretty good, I would imagine.
Well, it's good and liberating, but it's also, you carry the stress of it. And
how many people do you... But you employ a few people on the island now, don't you?
I employ a couple on the island now, yeah.
But that's still a worthwhile thing, surely, the fact that those jobs didn't exist before you got here, and that's an important part of the community as much as anything else.
Yes, yeah, and we've got offices in Christchurch, and we employ people there too. So No, but it's just... It's probably the stress and pressure of carrying that, you know,
responsibility for them as much as your own business.
And you and
You seem to like it though, because you've done other things in the community, like decided to take on again another thankless task, I suppose, and being president of the Waiheke Football Association and Football Club. I know personally that that's a huge amount of work and a lot of effort you put into that. Where do you find the time?
Well. I'm struggling at the moment. I think because I'm online a lot and I'm sitting at a computer, a lot of running the club on a day-to-day basis is email.
Yeah.
And I do it as part of my day.
Yep.
I think if you weren't online all the time, it would be...
It'd be a nightmare. It'd be done in the evenings.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But, you know, the club needs to sort of more get more people to help and delegate more. And,
yep.
You know.
Yep. No, but, absolutely.
I do it because I...
How many kids does the football club...
We've got 250 members. There's about 180 junior members.
Yeah. So 180 kids from Waiheke out enjoying the beautiful game.
Yep. And as a club, we're punching above our weight. We've got 5 kids in FTC, which is the Federation Talent Centre in Auckland. We've got teams leading divisions, winning divisions, extra junior team this year.
Yep.
So I think the club itself is it's doing really well. It's a great feeling about it. And
it's a good thing.
Yeah.
It's a very good thing. And you also involve yourself a lot with organising trips to Phoenix games and such. And I think that's a real benefit as well to the kids to be able to go and see that stuff. And seeing a big gang of kids like the Phoenix game at Eden Park was great. We had 60-odd people, didn't we, across the...
Yep. I think we tipped them over 18,000.
Yeah.
I think it was 18,000 and 59 people.
It was a great day.
Yeah.
It was a great day and the kids loved it.
Yep. We've got Ben Sigmund coming.
Yeah,
June 14th.
Ben Sigmund's an all-white. He plays for New Zealand.
Yep.
Probably
Phoenix.
Best known for his notorious tackle at a World Cup qualifying game.
Yes.
A two-footed monster.
Yeah.
But a very nice chap. He is a lovely guy. Mike, we're going to cut to another song now. This is A Sky Full of Stars by Coldplay. Tell us why.
This is a sort of an upbeat dance one, which sometimes I like. Coldplay... I've been a fan of Coldplay since Parachutes, their first album. In fact, I courted my wife to this album. She's not really... she likes Coldplay, but that wasn't really her type of music. She's more into hip-hop and R&B. But this was sort of common ground for us.
Right.
And he's just broken up with his wife, and his new album, Ghost Stories, it's all love songs to Gwyneth. Sky Full of Stars is just really upbeat, and so currently it's one of my favourite songs.
Here it is. Almost. There it is. Mike's just pointed out I'm playing the wrong track. I can't have that. It's been usual. I do 3 mistakes a show, by the way, Mike. Here's the correct track, Sky Full of Stars.
Cause you're a sky, cause you're a sky full of stars. I'm gonna give you my heart. Cause you're a sky.
Ooh. That was the right track that time. That was Coldplay, Sky Full of Stars. You're listening to Waiheke Radio here with guest Mike Gray on Mostly Locally. I'm your host, Andy. Sorry, I haven't really been that diligent in doing the updates during the course of this because time's flowing with Mike. He's had some funny old stories. We're going to go now, Mike, to the quickfire question round. So I've got a series of questions here. I normally say to guests you can pass on one only, but I think you'll have an answer for all of these, I'm pretty sure. Pretty inane, but here we go. What was the best advice your mum gave you? Don't live in a box under a car park and eat pies for 6 months. It'll mess with your mind.
I don't know, but the best thing I ever read was take on something. No, power comes to those who take on something greater than themselves. And I always remind myself of that when I'm doing something that feels like it's impossible.
Right. Power comes to those
who take on something greater than themselves. So when you're, if you don't actually think you can do it, but you do it because it's extending you.
Yeah.
In the process, suddenly you find it in yourself to
do
it.
So you're in the vortex staring at the abyss.
Yeah.
And the world's rushing around your ears and you're going, what the hell am I doing here? You take strength in that?
Well, no, suddenly you actually, in that process, you find power comes to you.
Yeah.
You actually then, you start being given the answers and do this and do that. And
yeah.
You're like, well, where's that coming from? Why am I doing this? Yeah. That's a really good idea. And suddenly, power does come to you and you then achieve the thing.
Yeah. And you think, but you'd never achieve it if you hadn't started it, right?
Well, that's because you don't, and the reason you don't is because of fear.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Awesome. That's very deep. what was your first job? I think we heard a bit of that. Was that Big Fresh or did you have something before that? Were you an entrepreneur right from the get-go?
Yes. Yeah. Cookie Time. Cookie Time used to sell like
Play Center.
No, Cookie Time, the biscuit. They used to do chocolate fundraisers.
Yeah.
With chocolate fish and that through schools.
Yeah.
And my mate and I, we ended up going and seeing them and buying all their old stock.
Yeah.
That still tasted nice, but it was, they wouldn't sell it anymore. And we bought it for pennies on the pound,
Yeah, yeah.
And then we drove to Ashburton, which is, we call it Ash Vegas, about an hour of Christchurch.
Yeah.
And we just flogged these chocolate fish off around the streets, through the shops, all the shops.
Yeah.
And I think we made $1,000.
Is that right? Selling chocolate fish?
In one day, yeah.
Is that right?
And we were driving back and there was all this cash in the glove box and he's counting it. And
yeah.
Yeah, so I've always been an entrepreneur.
Nice. So how old were you when you did that?
Oh, we would have been 16.
That's outstanding. You made $1,000. Yeah. Driving to Ashburton, selling lollies.
Selling out-of-date lollies. Semi-off chocolate fish.
There was a story in the Herald about that this morning, actually. They reckon if they didn't put best before dates on some certain types of produce that, huge amounts of wastage wouldn't happen. People see the best before and biff it. Do you eat out-of-date food?
I've got this thing where I don't like wasting food.
Yeah, yeah.
My wife has a thing where she won't eat something if it's not fresh.
Is that right?
So it's a bit of a dilemma,
Have you noticed?
Don't throw that out.
This is the weirdest thing. I found that cream has got like the half-life of something, unusual. I don't know whether it's because of the way that it's processed or not, but I've had cream in my fridge that is a month past its best before date, and I use the nose test because it's worked well for, our forefathers throughout history. Smell it, smell bad, don't eat, that kind of thing. But it still smells fine. I use it in cooking. It's perfectly fine. But, I'd be throwing away bottles of this stuff.
Yes,
how does that work?
I agree.
I'd have to do some research, find out why a cream has got a half-life of a nuclear reactor. If you would, if you could be world champion of anything, what would it be? Now, Mike, I would have thought
golf. Maybe golf.
What?
Yeah, I think just to be one person, and it's such a mental thing.
Oh, it's terrible. Do you play?
Yeah. No, well, I do, but I'm not very good. But no, just imagine it's all really, you've got your caddy.
Yeah.
But it falls really on you.
Yeah. It's the only sport like that, isn't it?
Yeah. And just the mental pressure.
It's amazing.
Yeah.
It's amazing. It's amazing when you see guys fold and you actually see people fold. I remember Justin Rose, when he was a young player, folded quite famously. That Belgian dude that hit three times into the water in another major. It's a terrible stress. It must be a very humbling experience failing at that because you're someone else to blame, is there?
No. And what about Michael Campbell? So he wins the US Open. But And I've watched his documentary about that. And as he was going down the final fairway and there's three or four holes to go,
yeah,
he was starting to lose focus with his eyes. And he said he had to go to the toilet.
Yeah.
So he goes into, you know, like a portaloo.
Yeah.
And he had this this technique. He'd do like a figure eight with his finger.
Yeah.
And he'd follow it to try and focus his eyes.
Yeah.
And so he goes in the toilet. He says he's got to go to the toilet just to do this for a few minutes to get his eyes focused.
Yeah.
And then he takes out and wins the thing. And then he's basically hasn't
done anything since.
And it must be a horrible feeling. It
must be a horrible feeling knowing that you could do it.
Well, you've done it once.
And you've done it, and
so
you just can't do it again.
You, but, yeah.
It's just eluded you. It's like through your fingers.
Yet,
at least he's been there.
Yeah, he did it.
At least he's been there, though.
Yeah, totally.
It's a bit like Man United's season this season.
Yes. Tiger Woods, I would relate that to Man U. So Tiger Woods was invincible, right?
Yeah.
And all his competitors knew it. They would crumble. He wouldn't.
Yeah.
Then, obviously, the personal problems.
Yeah.
And he's not the same.
No.
Man U, they had an amazing manager who got the best out of them. He leaves. Same players, but not the same.
Yeah, you know, Ella Riley asked me to mention Man United, by the way. I don't know why.
Well, she's a Nottingham Forest fan, and whilst they almost got into the playoffs for the... They didn't
For the umpteenth time.
Yeah.
Yes. One's great clubs. It's a bit like golf. What's the name of your favourite pet?
What about Steven Gerrard, just to swap? So Liverpool, played for the club for 20 years.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, that little slip up at the end of this.
Chelsea.
You can't blame him for
that. No, but... You know, here was a chance for him to win the
league. Oh, absolutely.
The league,
yeah.
Right? Which is what he'd want more than anything.
Yeah.
And he makes a mistake. It's not his fault, but that probably cost them.
It probably did.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, it's the first goal. A draw still wouldn't have been enough for them, but, well, it would have been,
had they beaten Palace, but...
Yeah.
And then to three goals in 8 minutes, I mean, just...
It's harsh.
Know, it would be horrible.
It would be horrible.
He'd be reliving that moment.
I can't blame Stevie G for that, though, because he's been such a great servant for Liverpool. And in some ways, it's almost destined to be that he doesn't win the league, because he's been England's one of the most consistent and best players for England, in England. Wonderful, loyal footballer, which you don't get too much anymore. He's been offered huge sums to go and play for other clubs, but no, he's the pull.
Yeah.
It's a shame. It's a real crying shame. Anyway, what's the name of your favourite pet?
Oh, Tiger.
Named after the golfer?
No, Tiger was a cat who was striped like a tiger, so I suppose that's why we called him Tiger.
And what was he your favourite?
Oh, he was my cat, but he died in a fire. Our house burnt down.
Oh, shit.
And he died.
That's traumatic.
Well, it was actually because
You in houses.
The fire brigade got him.
Yeah.
And they tried to, like, give him oxygen.
Resus the cat.
Yeah.
No mouth to mouth.
And it was on the footpath.
Yeah.
No, not mouth to mouth. And then...
Oh, so it was smoke inhalation that...
Well, I suppose so. Then I started crying, and Julie, I've forgotten her name, she went to school the next day and told everyone how I cried.
Heartless Julie.
Yeah.
Heartless Julie.
I was crying because my cat had died.
You don't know her surname?
No, I can't remember.
Was that the kind of general upbringing you got in Christchurch? Harsh shit like that.
No, but...
Mike crying, his cat died.
But I still remember it, and I would have been probably 6 or 7.
Well, that's harsh. Julie, if you're out there...
Yeah.
Bad form. Bad form. The man lost a cat for crying out loud.
Yeah.
His favourite cat.
Yeah.
When was the last time you got scared?
Last time I got scared.
Doesn't sound like you get scared, Mike, after that quote you gave us for the best advice.
Well, I actually do know, but I can't say why.
Really?
Yeah. So let's pass.
But no, it can't be a pass.
No, I sort of started having a panic attack, but I'm not prepared to say why.
Okay, good.
I find being on aeroplanes, and I fly on planes a lot.
Yeah.
There's always a moment on a plane where I just...
I used to fly on planes a lot. The thing I didn't like about it was you get so conditioned to what's normal. You know, the sound of the landing gear going down, sound of the landing gear going up, flaps coming out, all the shuttering, all the banging, all of the stuff. It's when there's stuff that you don't expect, and you look at that stewardess because you know it's not expected, and she's got a look of fear in her eye. Yeah. That's the one I don't like. I'll sit there and go, I've had it a couple of times now going, that's not normal. Look at the stewardess. She's like, that's not normal. Everybody else, blissfully unaware, all the irregular travellers, la, 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 I'll have another coffee, please, and I'm shitting my pants.
Yes.
Not funny.
And then now your mind's going, see, it's not normal. That's the way she's reacting. And then the pilot comes on straight away and you're this is not normal. You know, and you're looking around and your mind just starts telling you all the things. And then I have to now go, yeah, but, you know, hey, did you, I read this in the other day that the former Prime Minister of the Malaysia,
yep.
he he's out there saying, mate, that plane, the CIA know what happened to it.
No.
You can take them over. They can be remote controlled, operated. And what's really going on here? Because it didn't crash. And
no way.
Yeah, and he's out there saying stuff, all sort of stuff like that. I read that on the stuff the
Could
other day.
Could be a deflection. Who knows?
That was interesting.
I think it's great in this day and age that there is mystery still that can't be answered. I think it's healthy for us not to know in some ways, but it's certainly very unpleasant for the family.
Well, if you were on that plane, I mean, well, a plane's disappeared.
Yeah.
And no one knows what happened to it.
Yeah.
How is that possible in this day and age?
Well, exactly.
Like, you've got satellites that are constantly filming things.
You're going to get me onto a bugbear of mine, actually, Mike, now. Because we went for a family holiday a couple of weeks ago to the South Island, camper van, went to Punakaiki.
Yeah.
And there, I found a flipping wonderful thing. I don't believe it's the first time I even came close to the F-bomb on radio. Don't listen, kids. Swearing's not cool. The scientists still don't know how the rocks were formed, right? Now, we know a lot about geology. We know an awful lot about that. But, you know, the scientific community still admits, you know, well, you know, we're not quite sure how this taken place. We've studied it a lot. Even the best geologists in the world can't quite put their finger on how these pancake rocks were formed. And what geological conditions were present to form them. And then you've got other parts of the scientific community which come out saying, absolutely not, there is no global warming. How can you say there's no global warming? There's none, categorically. And I was sitting there going, well, what about Punakaiki? How can you admit you don't know that. How could you say that's for sure? I don't know. I find it really odd. So that's it. That's my comeback now. Well, for climate change deniers.
Yeah, the problem with the whole system is we base it on time, and time doesn't actually exist.
Oh, this is good.
So once you adapt, you know, adopt something like time.
Are you out of... So what about... Are you a time lord? Are you like Doctor Who?
No, I'm just saying, you know, there is no such thing as time, but we use time as a way of sort of...
Measuring,
putting constraints on. Well, to give us a basis of thing. And we have a calendar.
Yeah.
And yet, because the you know, it turns slightly differently, that every so often there's an extra day and we don't really allow for that. And when did things happen? Well, we don't really know. And and then we changed types of measuring systems and you know, so no one knows.
I'm probably gonna get shot down by the scientists for this, but the other thing I love about the anomalies of this is that the speed of light changes. Did you know this? It's varied over the last, you know, since they started measuring it. Not by a lot, given how fast light is, but it varies by about, you know, 20 meters a second every now and again, and they use it as a constant in all these calculations. They're saying it is constant, the speed of light is constant, but it's not.
Well, is it not constant, or is it just the measurement of it has become more refined?
Apparently, from what little I've read about it, and no doubt somebody will come and say something to me on Facebook at some point about, you dummy, didn't you know
it's
this?
Not constant.
But it's not. No, it's not a constant. Well, it varies.
Einstein said that if you travel at the speed of light away from the Earth for, say, 3 years, when you return, say 100 years will have passed on Earth, okay? So I have this film concept where the Earth has become this horrible place, and the richest man on the Earth who controls, he owns all the HIV-free blood, for example, and water and air. So you either live in an oxygenated environment or you're in the scum part. The only thing that drives him, the only reason he lives and wants all his money is he wants to build a spaceship that can travel at the speed of light. That's what drives him.
Yeah.
And he's on Mars drilling for water because we've run out of it here. And so and there's some cataclysmic event, and he has to get into his spaceship, and it's not ready, but he shoots off, and he's traveling, you know, very fast, and turns around. When he comes back to Earth, you know, 150 years has passed, and he comes flying through the sky in his silver spaceship, and now man survived, but man's back to caveman days, and everyone's in there, running around naked, and there's no cities, it's just trees and flowers and
nice.
And he lands in his silver spaceship, and they look to him because he must be a god because he's come from the skies. And then he knows what became of the Earth, and now the Earth has returned. And what does he do? Because he was this evil, you know, emperor.
Yeah.
And now he's arrived to find this pristine planet again.
This is Eden-esque.
Yeah. And they look to him because he's a god. And which way does he take it?
This leads me to my next question. Yes. What did you have for breakfast besides acid?
I didn't have any acid for breakfast. I didn't have breakfast. I still haven't eaten.
Do you not eat breakfast?
No, oh, got the kids to school, went to work. Oh, got radio show, got here late, you know.
Nice. Nickname? Do you got a nickname, Mike?
Endo.
Endo?
Yeah.
Endoskeleton?
No, endo. Means within.
Right.
Yeah.
Nice. And where'd you get that from? Who gave you that, Endo?
Oh, it's back from the band days.
Yeah. Right. Was this like Bono?
It's my rock star.
Is it your rock name? It's my stage name. Endo.
Yeah.
Weapon of choice.
Oh, love.
Oh, that's sweet.
No, it's powerful.
What's the worst thing about getting old? Are you getting old? Since there's no concept of time, I suppose you're not.
The worst thing is that your body can't do what your mind
wants it to.
Yeah, or what your mind thinks it can.
Yeah, anymore. You do, I've been thinking about taking up yoga because I reckon being bendy is important as you get older because you get less bendy.
Yeah.
That's my...
Flexibility. Totally. Yeah. I do yoga and stretching and I need to do more.
We're right on the edge of time here, Mike.
Yeah.
Which is a real shame because I think we're probably...
That's true.
Well, I've got this man-made clock thing on the operating system on this PC telling me otherwise, but I'm with you, actually. I like that concept, the fact that, you know, time's just a man-made device to control stuff.
Yeah.
But it's been a real pleasure having you on the show. Last question I've got to ask, and we haven't really touched on any of the other bits about what I'd love to have touched on today around Christchurch and the impact of that and your view on that. I went down there the other day, and I think everybody in New Zealand should go and have a drive around and experience what it's like down there, because it is nothing short of shocking. That whole Hereford Street, you know, where you used to work. I used to go into Hereford. I used to work for Telecom. And walking up Hereford Street, I just remember going up there, and nothing on the right-hand side of that road is there anymore. It's just gone, and the whole centre's gone. It's scary. But I might try and encourage you back on the show again in the next few weeks to talk a bit more illegal. I'm sure there's other stuff we could cover on that. But Waiheke, you made the choice to come here. It's a great place to live. What's the thing you think is the most precious about the island? What's something you wouldn't like to see change?
Well, what I really like about here is that, to me, it's like a microcosm of New Zealand. And it feels like it's like you live in the memory of your favourite summer of childhood here. I think it's kind of how you remember it as a kid, but it's real, it's now.
Yeah.
Everyone seems to care about things here. Everyone waves to everyone, people are friendly. People will protest if they're not happy.
Yeah.
We have local papers holding, you know, local politicians to account. There's dialogue. There's a vast range of people, and yet we have these modern houses, but we also have these old batches, and we have these beautiful beaches. And it's like everything that you could want is here in this little confined space. And yet it feels to me like it's to me it's like my favorite summer of childhood in a way.
It's a great way of looking at it.
Yeah, I think it's just this unique little place, and you know, I've never been one to be against change, and so change will always occur.
It's a constant.
It's just a natural thing.
It's a bit like the speed of light. It's going to happen.
Yeah, and so you know, it'll just be what it is. But I think it's good for people to fight for what they want, believe in, and protest. And you know. So I'm just enjoying being a member of the community.
A local. Well, I think the island's better off having you here, Mike. It's been a pleasure having you here this morning. Thank you very much for coming on.
No, thank you.
We'll try and get another slot for you. You've been listening to Mostly Locally here on Waiheke Radio. I'm your host, Andy Durrant. We've been having a great hour and a bit with Mike Gray. We haven't had a chance to play nearly half of his music, but we'll just go out on... you got a choice. Which song would you like to go out on, Mike? Toulouse, Where You Stand, or the Gale song?
We'll go out with Travis, Where You Stand.
Travis, Where You Stand. Okay.
Album.
This is Travis, Where You Stand. Thanks again, Mike.